Welcome to the Visual Storytelling Podcast. My name is Fred Ranger, and I'm so happy that you're joining us today for another very inspirational conversation. Today, my friends, I have with me a very special guest. His name is Hunter Hart. He is a Nashville-based photographer. He does weddings, commercial, senior portraits, portraiture. He's also a fellow YouTuber, and he happens to shoot Leica and Fujifilm. Hunter, we've got a lot in common, but first, welcome to the show, man.
Glad to be here, man. Hey. The intro was really nice. The song, too, was just fantastic. Kind of get me pumped up a little bit.
I guess I had a little bit of Nashville vibes, right, in it? Like a bit of, you know, country slash indie.
Yeah, really nice.
So I'm so glad we're talking today because I've got a lot of questions for you. We've been following each other for a little while. And we've been interacting, and I think I really, really enjoy your work and the way you've been putting in, you know, some documenting, you know, the process along the way and sharing it on YouTube. So this is, again, very similar to what I'm trying to do. So first off, for the people who don't know you, can you walk us through a bit on how you actually became a professional photographer and why you decided to make it your day job, basically?
It was kind of... It's kind of a long, interesting story, I would say. Started painting whenever I was really young, so I kind of understood lighting and composition a little bit already. And it took forever to do a painting or any kind of drawing or anything that I was doing. And I picked up a camera at a very young age. My mom had one that had the floppy disk in it. It was a Sony. I don't know if you remember those.
Floppy disks. Okay.
Yes. And it would hold like 5 photos. And I would just erase them after I was done because it was full and I didn't know what to do with them. And that was like the first time that I ever really got into photography at all. And then I kind of set it down. And in high school, I would go to parties with a little point and shoot. And this was before Facebook was actually huge. It was there. It was just kind of getting started. And people would ask me for the photos afterwards. So it was like a way for me to make friends. And I picked up a bit better of a camera later on when I was early in college. And the instant gratification is really what hooked me once I found out, like, I know what I'm doing right now versus just shooting at parties and stuff. And so the instant gratification definitely caught me for photography because it's a lot faster than painting anything. Usually about 1/2000th of a second, actually.
You're right.
So I had several jobs. I was farming and I was working at a frame shop and I was doing photography on the side as well. And over the years, I just kind of cut one job after the other and eventually was able to do it on its own. It took a long time. It was not easy. It's still not easy, but moving to different places is a little bit harder. So Nashville, I had to start completely over. I had a huge clientele in Mississippi where I'm from and been here for 2 years, but it's going pretty good now. It's just taking a little while.
Well, good to hear things are back in full swing. So explain that move to me. So what brought you to Nashville and how different is it in terms of photography community than Mississippi?
Well, in Mississippi, I lived in a mid-sized town. And I kind of semi-cornered the market there. And I think I just expected it to be really easy to go somewhere else because I had such a great portfolio. I was like, oh, that's all I need is a portfolio and just like a good mindset and that'd be great. But that's not the case because Nashville's very oversaturated with photographers. Huh. And one of the reasons that we moved here is because I wanted to photograph artists, which I have done and I'm still doing, but I want to do it on a larger scale. And that's kind of where I want to be. And I would like to document them behind the scenes, like a backstage photographer kind of, not necessarily always going on tour or anything, but that's kind of my dream as far as what I'm doing in Nashville. Obviously there's other things like photojournalism and stuff that I like to do. And hopefully that will pick up here too as well. But as far as artists go, that's really the push that took us here.
Man, it's so true what you're saying. So I've been in Nashville a couple times. both for pleasure and business and to shoot. And man, this city is just music everywhere. I'm a musician too. I think you are one too. But at the end of the day, you just walk in on any street and there's music, you know, something related to music. There's literally music playing on the street, or there's a band playing in a bar, or there's an artist passing by, or there's a little, you know, get together with some people playing music. So if you are into music, I mean, there's a couple cities in the U.S. I mean, you think about Austin and Nashville and, you know, all these great cities, but there's something unique about Nashville. And I can fully understand why you decided to move there if you know, photographing artists is something you wanted to do moving forward.
Yeah.
But so you decided to move there to photograph artists and so on and so forth, but you are also doing a lot of other types of photography. How does one actually come up with a style when you do a lot of different variations of photography, because people are hiring you for a very specific reason, not just availability, but also your style, your voice, the way you interact with clients, and the end result, the actual end product. So how do you develop your voice throughout so many different genres of photography?
I think this is really funny, and this is how I kind of made my style the way it is the town that I was from did have decent photographers. Some of them are really good. And I just kind of looked at their work and I was like, I'm going to do everything they're doing, but backwards. So I started doing everything instead of backlit, just did it like harsh light.
Nice.
And then it just turned into underexposed, very contrasting, moody photos. And then I kind of understood how to run with that aspect of everything. And you can do this on a different scale depending on what you're photographing. You can do this at weddings, but still make it look elegant at the same time. And you can also do it with corporate, but also make it professional at the same time. And I just kind of morphed what I do normally into just a little bit of a different genre throughout all of my work. So I think it does have like a nice flow to it when you look at it, which, as you could probably tell, it all looks the same, but just different.
Yep.
Areas within photography. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Oh, 100%. Those tones, man. I don't know how you get them, but you are really, really somebody who have an attention to detail and consistency in the body of work. And that's something I want to commend you for, because taking nice images, I don't want to say it's easy, but it's easier than being very consistent and having, again, that attention to the level of details that you're putting in. And if you go, and I really invite everybody to go see Hunter's Instagram, because if you flow in and you scroll down, you'll see what we're talking about, that consistency, those tones. I like how everything is not, you know, just poppy and flashy. It's actually, I don't want to say muted, because that's not the word I'm looking for, but there's, again, I don't, how would you describe your style? I'll let you talk about your style versus me trying to find the right word to talk about it.
It's kind of hard to describe, honestly. A lot of people call it moody, contrasty, and
moody. That's
I've had somebody call it evocative, because it's thought provoking. And I think some of them are, I'm not saying all of them are at all, but, I think that that's a good way to put it, I guess. That's the best way I've heard it described. Same person described it in that way always, but
I think it's a nice way to describe it. And I think a bit like me, you've got also a nice wife that you travel with. So it makes for an instant model anywhere in the world. And that's an advantage, right? Isn't it, Hunter?
Yeah. I'm one of the people that I'm sure you're the same way too. I think there's, this is something that I run into quite often, is that, I always bring a camera with me,
yeah,
no matter what I'm doing. I'm not sure. Are you the same way?
Absolutely, 100%.
Yes, right. So there's photographers out there that do not do that at all. They're like, there's work and then there's no work. And I'm just like, this isn't just work for me. This is definitely a hobby of mine as well. And I want to continue that. So having a wife that will allow me to photograph her is one of the best things in the world.
I can relate.
Because I have 100%. I have a model with me all the time.
There you go. And I think it's actually good, because we're practicing even while having fun, you know. So like some other type of work, you need to, you know, be very concentrated and spend a lot of time understanding the back. But here, it's, you know, traveling with our cameras, and hey, nice background, it would look nice in there, just go in there, and then boom, you're practicing your composition, your reading of light while having so much fun with somebody, hopefully, that you love more than anything else. So that's, I think it's a full win-win-win situation.
It really is. Because if you're in those situations and just pretend that you don't have a camera, like, you would just be thinking about it the whole time, like, that light over there is so nice. This composition would be great if I could just have a person stand here. Oh, wait, I do have a wife there and I do have a camera, so always ready.
But you did touch upon a good subject, which is work versus, you know, pleasure and just, you know, walking around with your camera. Some photographers I talk to, they have their work cameras and they have their fun/personal project cameras. Are you that? And we had a discussion pre-show about Leica, Fuji, whatever, and we wanted to keep some for the show. So I'm asking you, are you the same? Do you have your work camera and your fun camera, or are they the same?
Yeah, so actually, can we talk about gear a little bit? Is that okay?
You and I have a YouTube channel that does just that, so I think we can we can allow ourselves on this podcast to talk about that too.
So I usually have a camera that I always have for about a year or so, and I keep it as kind of like something that I can review very well and very detailed. And so I always do have I call it a toy camera, even though it's usually my most expensive camera that I own, but I just shoot it whenever I feel kind of provoked by whatever situation I'm in to shoot something. I had the GFX 50S for a while, for a year, and I caught a lot of flack from getting rid of it for the Leica SL. So right now, my main camera that I'm actually playing with, I guess you could say, to compartmentalize my hobby and my work, would be the Leica SL, and I have a ton of lenses with it. So I've actually probably been using it a little bit more than I ever thought I would. I just shot an entire wedding on it in New York, and I didn't shoot anything else except one lens and one camera. I definitely have a camera that's going to be for fun, and then cameras that are going to be for work, even though the Leica SL has fallen into work somehow. I've enjoyed it, so.
And isn't it weird that people are so adamant about, you know, you shooting a certain brand, or, you know, and again, being a Fuji/Leica, I would say a bit more Leica now, but a shooter, I get the same type of feedback, like, oh, you know, why are you using this and this and that? I'm like, guys, this is a tool. You can buy whatever you want. You can buy a Sony. I don't care. We're talking about, you know, stuff we know and stuff we own. So, you know, I cannot talk about a Panasonic camera that I don't have. I happen to have, you know, a Leica camera and a Fuji camera. So I'll talk about that. So I think, and I'm sure you've experienced it too, but there's so much attention to specs and camera details and what it can do that, I don't know if you're like me, but owning those Leica cameras, you kind of get rid of that pressure of specs. Because at the end of the day, you're making the photo. And if a Leica camera or another type of brand makes you feel the right way when you have it in your hand, and it simplifies the process, at least for me, it simplified the process in terms of setting up the camera and getting it to where I want it to be. That's what it should be about, not the camera brand itself. How do you feel about that?
I completely agree 100% with you. I've definitely run in to the situation where I think a lot of people do get caught up in specs, and that's what I don't push on my YouTube. Like, most of the cameras I'm using are older because I don't need anything else. The thing is to me, is whatever makes you shoot better or makes you feel like you want to go shoot is the proper camera for you, no matter what it is. It doesn't even have to be digital or film or whatever. You know, it can be something from 2012, like the 5D Mark III, for instance, that I still have and use, which is not up to spec for anything.
Pretty darn good camera still today.
And it's fantastic. One of my favorite cameras of all time, with a 35mm 1.4 by Sigma. It's great. And I think that that's something that people, they spend a lot of money and they shouldn't. And I think that any camera manufacturer that heard this would hate me, but I just don't think they're worth it anymore.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, like, if you can shoot 120 frames per second, I'm talking about as like a camera, like a photography camera, not video. I just don't know what you do with that. Like, I don't understand. And the megapixels, like, most people aren't printing on billboards. Anything over 24 megapixels is kind of overkill. Although we do have cameras with more than that, because there's no more options anymore. So when you get a camera, it's going to have a ton of megapixels, and that's something you're going to have to deal with on the back end. Even though it sounds good, Is it good? I've never had a wedding client at all complain about 24 megapixels or 50 megapixels or whatever I'm using, such as the GFX. But I think specs are overrated.
I 100%. And to your point, and I've said that a couple of times on this podcast, the past 5 years, there's no bad cameras. You go back 5 years. Yeah. I mean, at first, when camera manufacturers were coming up with like big innovation, like having a D3 sensor in a D700 and a Nikon body, wow, that's incredible. And then the frames per second were for sports shooters and so on and so forth. The past 5 years, guys, it's all the same crap. Then it becomes a personal and personal preference. How does it feel in your hand? Are you invested in a certain brand in terms of lenses and so on and so forth? Those should be the determinant factors versus specs and so on. Because to Hunter's point, they pretty much all 40 megapixel or 26 and above, and again 26 is pretty much more than enough. And of course, the some of them are faster on the autofocus, but nothing that you cannot work with. And you're talking about the SL1, right? Not the SL2.
Yeah.
There you go. So you have it there. So. Go see Hunter's work and then tell me that, an SL is not enough. He can definitely prove you wrong on that. Speaking of gear, and that's, I guess, the last portion of the gear portion of the show, because if not, it's going to become a longer conversation. Maybe you and I do a separate podcast about just the gear.
I could definitely do that.
Me too. But speaking of the gear, there are fixed lenses cameras that you use, and you told me that the Q, I think the original Q was part of the ecosystem. Of course, the X100, and then you've got of course big cameras with interchangeable lenses. How do you decide to go for one or the other? What's the deciding factor to go out of the house with a certain type of camera?
So I came. This is really funny. I had the Leica Q and the X100V at the same time, which is a weird conundrum to be in, because they are very similar in a lot of ways as far as compact, both fixed lenses. And I just found myself picking up the X100V a lot more, and I don't know why. And it's hard to explain. Is this like maybe because it's smaller, or maybe it's easy for my wife to use? I'm not sure why I do that, but I would pick it up a lot more. So I eventually got out of the Q and ended up selling the Q. But the reason I got rid of the Q is because it doesn't have redundancy, and now hopefully the Q3 does, so I could get that. But I'll have to sell my car and my kidney or liver for that.
Yeah, man. I think all the rumors. I don't have any inside information on the Leica stuff, but they're pointing to it having a tri-resolution sensor, just like the new M11, and also having probably internal memory, and hopefully with those big megapixel 47 and plus, or 60 megapixel even, hopefully a 256 or even maybe a 512 gigabyte internal. That would be awesome, right?
I think that would be great. Yeah. So to answer your question, I think the real reason I picked up whatever camera I was leaving with is this: whatever made me feel the best in that day. That didn't always pick up the X100V. I just picked it up more often. I think it's a feeling that you get, and it's really hard to explain. It's kind of intuition almost. So
it has nothing to do with the megapixel count, because I think you mentioned in the video, like, the GFX is great, makes incredible images, but do you really miss, let's put it in quotes, the medium format or large format look from GFX?
Okay, that's a good question. yes, I do. I loved the 65-1.4 on that camera, because it looked like the 110 f/2.8 on my RZ67, and that is something that I will miss, but I won't miss dealing with it.
Yeah,
like, if that makes sense, because it was so heavy, it was so annoying to carry around. And the Leica SL is a larger camera, but it's nowhere even close to that.
Yeah,
not even a bit.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna miss that part of it, the actual image itself, but not taking the photos. That makes sense.
Absolutely. What do you film your videos, your YouTube videos with these days?
I use an X-T4 and usually an 18-1.4 for that, and then a filter on that. And I love that camera. It's great. And I do like the flippy screen, because I can see myself whenever I'm making videos. So I know a lot of people didn't want the hybrid part of it, because it's like more of a photographer camera, but I haven't switched to the X-T5. because I don't need to.
I have the XH2S, and I can agree. Couldn't agree more on that flippy screen. So handy, especially when you're, you know, just want to flip the camera on and start talking, you know, not in this big studio setup. It's so convenient to have that. And the Fuji colors, I mean, again, it's the cameras are all the same, but there is such a thing as color science, and I'm going to get some hate in the comments for saying that, even saying that word. But again, you might like it, you might not like it. And yes, you can shoot RAW and you can shoot F-Log and then get it to exactly the same as blah, blah, blah. But I'm a simple guy, and I guess you too, Hunter, and we don't like to spend hours and hours and hours trying to fix a skin tone on a video. You know what I mean?
No, I usually just shoot classic neg on my video and just leave it that way. I don't mess with it. I kind of get it right in camera and then just shoot and go, and that's it. No, it's kind of cheating, but at the same time, it makes my life a lot easier.
Yeah, I agree. Did you dabble into any Eterna film sim?
Yes, I like Eterna too, but I feel like I always have to do something to it afterwards.
Pop up the colors a bit, the contrast. Right. It's kind of like the in between F lug maybe one and having a, you know, a fully colored image. So it gives you a bit of wiggle room if you want to color grade it.
I'd agree with that. 100%.
So that portion of the show was sponsored by all the Gear Acquisition Syndrome Association out there. So if we gave you gas, well, we're not liable. You can't sue us. Sorry.
Yeah. We don't condone of you buying a new camera.
Exactly. We're just suggesting solutions to your problems. There you go. Yeah. So Hunter, I want to go back to the image that you share on you know your website and Instagram. I know it's a tricky question and there's no right or wrong answer, but for you, what makes a good image, either that you took or when you look at a book or somebody else's work?
I would say composition, lighting, and framing, all of those combined, no matter what you're using. I think that those three things, when they align, that ends up making a great photo. And it makes it even better if there's emotion involved in the photo, which sometimes is hard to do. And, you know, that's something that only lasts for a split second. And I think whenever all four of those things are put together, that's almost a perfect photo, in my opinion.
I agree. And sometimes, you know, we try to be very fancy with how to describe a photo. But to your point, I think the basic stuff, you know, composition, the light, and if you can throw in emotion in there, I think you've got a winner. And
yeah, I think so too. I think that's all there is to it. And you can capture that with just about anything.
Absolutely. And speaking of capturing nice photos, you did mention on your website that you feel blessed with OCD and ADHD. And I want to talk about that because you're not the first photographer that I interviewed that you know, puts that as an advantage. I have an episode with Lucas van der Lende. I always butcher last names. Anyways, Lucas, who pretty much I think is aligned with you on that one. So can you talk a bit more about how is this a superpower?
I don't know if it's a superpower or not, but it took me a long time to understand that it was a good thing for the things that I'm doing. ADHD, I can't concentrate on anything. So whenever I'm doing a photo shoot, if I plan anything out, you might as well throw it out the window because I'm going to go just off to the right or the left. But hey, this looks good. Let's go over here. And that's just kind of my personality. Whenever I'm shooting, I become just a completely different person and then like am just all over the place. So having that continuously just like, you know, bombarding my brain and just it's like just not having a schedule for me is what ends up happening. So I think that helps me a lot because otherwise I wouldn't get half of the photos or 90% of the photos that I take because they're all spur moment and I don't plan it. You know what I mean? And as far as OCD goes, I have to get my images done very quickly. I have a 72-hour turnaround time because it's like it just sits on top of me. Yeah. And if I don't do it now, then my whole world comes tumbling down. So I edit my photos very quickly. Other than weddings, take a while, but most photo shoots within 72 hours, I'll be done with them.
Wow. So you're not the type of guy who's like, well, I'm going to sit on it for a month or two and then go back to it and then, you know, process it.
No, because I would just be thinking about those and then I wouldn't be able to sleep. And this is something that I have to do. So that's definitely where the OCD part comes in.
Yeah.
So those two mixed together to me work very well and make a nice mesh which is strange, but
well, I think in terms of creativity also, I mean, you did mention that your brain is always like, you know, on high alert of something, you know, that you could be catching, or a nice scene that you could be capturing, or putting, you know, the subject in front of something. So how do you deal with the clients though? Because some of the clients might be intimidated by that approach. So how do you position it with some of the, I would say, tougher clients?
90% of the clients that I have say, I don't know what to do.
Okay.
Will you just tell me? And that's great because I'm very directive and I can tell people what to do. And I think that's also a superpower to have, because if I can tell you what to do, you don't feel awkward. So I think that it works for the most part. And obviously there's some things like very large events and stuff that have nothing to do with very much creativity involved at all, even though you can get creative angles, but they're like, this is how it's going to be. Here's the time and things that you have to deal with. And that's something that I can obviously, you know, transition into, and that's okay. So I'm pretty malleable when it comes to things like that, but the way that I typically shoot is the other way that I was talking about. So I'm flexible. If I'm outside shooting somebody or in an environment where it's photojournalistic, I just kind of am all over the place.
Yeah, man. And I love how on your Instagram you say, you know what, I'm directive, so you don't have to be. So it sets the record straight and it's manage expectations. I love it.
Yeah, it does. It helps a lot.
So you are doing a lot of weddings. And I think one thing that I really respect for a wedding photographer is that you are capturing the most important day of somebody's life. And it is a, you know, something that they will cherish for the hopefully, you know, many, many, many years. Can you talk about how do you work with people that are about to give you money to capture the most important day of their lives? Is there a way to reassure them? Because I know a lot of photographers are like, hey, I want to make a living out of photography, and wedding is definitely something that we're interested in pursuing. So what would be the tips and tricks you would give to people, you know, just starting out and like, hey, how do I even, you know, go about doing weddings?
I think so. The first few weddings that I ever shot were hardly paid at all. I mean, I just had to do it to make sure that I knew how to do it. I wasn't a second shooter for anybody. I have been in my later years, but in the first 9 years, I don't think I ever photographed with anybody other than my second shooters that I would hire. So I think kind of just jumping in the deep end, honestly, is the best thing that I would suggest, you know, and just don't charge a lot because you're not there yet. And it's okay. All of us have our photographic journey, and it takes a while to get and understand what clients need, because there's so many things that you have to get right. And that's just a learning curve that you have to find out yourself. I mean, you can watch as many YouTube videos as you want, but if you don't do it, then you're never going to know what to really do. And there's no book out there for it. I mean, you have to just fill it out. Intuition's a lot of it. And after you get those under your belt, I think the best thing we'll do is to kind of make some packages and then just see how people respond to that. Make sure you have a portfolio, put this stuff out there, especially if you want to be a wedding photographer. SEO works really well for wedding photographers. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely suggest working with an SEO. Also, post all the time, shoot as much as you possibly can. And that's honestly the best I can do as far as what I think you should do to start.
And I think you're also working with your wife, if I'm not mistaken, on that portion of the business, right?
So my wife, when we met, she did not know how to photograph very well. And so I taught her how through COVID and everything, and she became my second shooter. So she's my permanent second shooter, unless she's out of town or something, and then I'll hire somebody else.
Nice.
Which is really nice because we're a great team and we understand each other very well. And that's just been a blessing.
You know what? I think it's a very interesting and lovely situation to have, you know, your wife at your side, because it's all about trust, right? At the end of the day, it's trust between the couple who is hiring you, trust in yourself, trust in your second shooter. If that person happens to be your wife and you have that trust, then it's a very solid, you know, foundation for, again, a day that will never come back in time. And that is very important for the people who are getting, at the end of the day, the images.
Yeah, so I would highly recommend marrying your second cheater.
Here's a tip for everybody.
This is the best tip I have because she does a lot of admin work for her. Bless her heart. She's so good at it. She does most of the business stuff on the photography, and she's great, and I love it that I don't have to deal with it, and she does it. And I'm just a very blessed individual to have her in my life.
Well, you know what? It's very, 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 very lovely message. But so model, second shooter, and admin. Where do you find those people, Hunter?
South Africa.
South Africa. Okay, good to know. So now we know when our next trip will be or where our next trip will be. Let's talk about people because you photograph a lot of people. You do portraiture and so on and so forth. How do you go about connecting with somebody that you're capturing a photo of? Because I see a lot of your photos where you're talking about emotion. I feel something when I look at a portrait that you make or that you take. So how do you connect with the other individual in front of you?
That's kind of a hard question, I think. But I usually just kind of get to know them for a few minutes before, and I kind of fill them out a little bit, and I can see where their angles are and what they, you know, what would look best for them. And at the same time, I'm looking at lighting, like as we're talking and everything. And then I don't know, I just kind of place them in the best spots that I could think of, and that showed their attitude or their personality the most. And I just kind of feed off of that. And once you're doing a photo shoot and you kind of get loosened up in the first like 10, 15 minutes, then you really get to dive into it. And then that's where the fun stuff starts, because it always starts out a little bit slow because we don't know each other very well. And then you can see my personality and their personality kind of connecting and working together as a unit, essentially. Mm.
A great example of that is the photo shoot you did at Hans Christian Andersen. Thanks. You said thanks, Partnership Books. I don't know if it was for the book, the library, or it was a model, or what was that?
That was actually a senior shoot.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
But I like the nice framing, and I can see while you were talking to me about you finding the angles and the light and mm-hmm. adding your personality to it. I think this is a great example of, you know, how you've been able to do that. And how long does a shoot like that take for you to run?
That one was 1 hour, okay. I believe.
Wow.
So it just depends on what I'm doing. Usually I go from 1 hour to 2 hours, and then I have a day rate also. So like if I'm getting hired for any kind of assignments, that's where that comes into play.
Nice.
But yeah, usually most photo shoots, like with models or anything, last between 1 to 2 hours.
Nice. Well, you've been doing a great job in 1 or 2 hours. I can say that because the work you do is it feels like if you were there for 3 days doing scouting and stuff. So kudos on that one.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Photojournalism, portraits, weddings. Is there one that you know, you wake up in the morning, is there one aspect of photography you're like, wow, this is why I do photography and I want to do more of it moving forward?
So I would say editorial documentary work, anything like that. So photojournalism falls into that category as well because you're documenting everything. So I would say if I could be anything for the rest of my life, it would be a photojournalist, 100%.
It just sucks that the money isn't really there anymore for that type of...
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely not. That's where weddings come into play. You have to do the hard stuff to do the stuff you love. And weddings can definitely be difficult, like we talked about earlier.
I feel like, and I always go back to music because this is my roots. It's like, you know, being in a cover band versus doing your own composition, right? So you kind of have to do, you know, a bit of covers to pay for the other side of the biz.
I had that exact conversation with somebody I photographed yesterday who is in a band called Rock Eupora, which Eupora is the town that I'm from in Mississippi, which is funny because I never would have thought I would have met somebody that was from a band named after this very small town. So that's kind of interesting, but he said the exact same thing as you did.
Yeah, man, it's definitely feel this way. Your use of black and white, you have a section on your site dedicated to it. What's your relationship with black and white? Why and how do you decide to say, you know what, this calls for black and white scene?
I would shoot. So whenever I'm photographing things, I photograph in black and white and then I edit in color. So that's already how I'm seeing it. Black and white, if I could photograph everything in black and white for the rest of my life, 100% would. I love color, but something about black and white just really I don't know, it sticks with me because it isolates the subject so much, because there's nothing to get in your way of seeing the subject at all. And I just really like black and white. It isolates the subject very well and makes you understand a lot faster what's going on than it would in color. Which I know it's only a split second, but that's a split second that just, I don't know, it's just very punchy to me.
Yeah, man, that's so true. And I think we just created a new want or need. No, a new want. I think you want a dedicated black and white sensor hunter. No?
Yeah, M11 monochrome.
There you go. I don't know. I'm just saying.
I would kill for one for sure. That would be amazing.
Well, you only have to sell your car, your house, a kidney, and then off you go with your M11 monochrome.
Yeah.
No, but to your point, I think there is value in having simplicity in photography. And if you can take, because some people think, oh, throw it in black and white, it'll be a nice image. It'll make a poor image look good. And I completely disagree with that. I think if you can make a black and white photo look very good, you've actually invested a lot of time in understanding the composition and the story and the feeling and all the great stuff you said. I think it's the opposite. Sometimes a color photo distracts you, to your point, and look at a nice red and so on and so forth. Black and white, it doesn't forgive, you know. You have to have a nice composition and a nice understanding of the shadow, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I would ask anybody out there just to try shooting raw, but change your color profile to black and white.
Yeah.
And to see how it makes you feel, because you can see things completely different. Your whole world looks different. And then when you get home, all of them will be in color, but you'll remember in your mind, like, this one was great in black and white, so I can change that one.
And that's kind of how. And if you happen to shoot the Fuji film, and Acros, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very, very interesting film simulation. It gives you some, you know, very contrasty. Reminds me a bit of Tri-X. So let's talk about film. Do you shoot film at all, or are you're because you did mention the RZ, the RB?
Yeah. So I did shoot a lot of 120 for a year, because that was my camera for a year, and then I went to the GFX because I love the medium format so much. So I did shoot a lot of 120, and I still have one medium format film camera, and then I have quite a few film cameras, and I don't shoot them enough, but I'll usually shoot them at weddings as like a gift to the client to have some nice film, and we get it developed at Indie Film Labs in Montgomery, Alabama. So yeah, I do shoot film, and I love film, and it just still scares me, because I'm like, if this doesn't turn out, this is going to be a disaster. And
Phantom Roll.
For the most part, they do pretty well.
Did you, like me, ever shot a Phantom Roll?
A Phantom Roll? Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's I mean, for me, it was in Portugal, and I'm like, oh, this is so nice. My girlfriend's still sleeping. I'm in the street. And I, you know, when you feel good about the shots you're taking, like, wow, okay, this is great. Oh my God. I'm in the mood. I'm in the zone.
Yes.
And I come back to Montreal. I'm not going to say it on this podcast, because I want to keep my clean rating, but I swear it a lot. It was a Phantom Roll. Anyways, so that's
sorry.
Yeah, but I did have some pretty nice, decent shot with the digital camera. So it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, backup redundancy. You have to have it, especially in this world.
Favorite film stock on the color front and black and white?
Oh, I would say CineStill 50D.
Wow,
that's my favorite, just because I like to shoot out in the bright areas, and a lot of people don't I think that's a very underrated film stock, honestly. It's just really fun. And Portra 400, obviously classic. I mean, it's just nice, it looks good, and skin tones are beautiful, and those are probably my two favorite. If I had to pick any film to shoot for the rest of my life, it'd be those two. And I would have to definitely avoid low light
situations. But that Portra, I started watching YouTube videos about film and stuff, and like everybody else, I said, man, this is just hyped up. It can't be that good. And then I shot a roll, and then I shot another one, and then I shot 100 Portra 400. I'm like, okay, I understand why. Seriously above anything else. But again, it might not please everyone. Some people like the Fuji color a little bit more, like more, you know, green and cold. And but the Portra, especially when you travel to a warm destination, like, again, I shot it in Portugal, shot it in Italy, and it just calls for it. Like, it's just beautiful, you know.
So I guess Portia is your favorite film stock then?
Oh, yeah. I tried to avoid it, not to sound like another YouTuber who just said, oh, Portia 400. I loaded my M6 with Portia 400. But yeah, I mean, I do use an M6 and Portia 400.
So that's great. So yeah. I think Portia is the way to go. I'm glad that you like that film. I mean, what else are you going to shoot?
I mean, sometimes, you know, I want to go a bit cheaper on the budget side. So, you know, Kodak Gold 200 is perfect. It's great. And they're all Kodak Max even. It's great. But then you put a roll of Portia and you're like, ah, you know, this is why I keep spending so much money on that type of film. Yeah,
it is getting expensive. And speaking of expensive, have you heard of Dehancer?
I did, and I actually they reached out for me to test out there. Yeah, there you go.
So did you use it for Lightroom?
I Lightroom, no, I'm using it for Final Cut right now, but I'm about, and they did follow up. So the answer, people, if you're listening to this podcast, I promise I will get to it. But now my next step will be to test it for Lightroom. How it is? You tested it?
I've been working on it, and I was just wondering what you thought as far as what that's going to do for the industry of film, because obviously it does look very reminiscent. And the thing is like, it's still not film though. And at what point are we going to say, you know, it either is or it isn't, you know, like, you're a film photographer or you're not a film photographer. And I think that's just going to be the end of it. I don't know what the obsession is with making things look like film if you're not shooting film. But it is interesting to see how close it can look to film. So I'm trying to understand the implementation of it. Other than that, I know film's very expensive and you want it to look a certain way, but I feel like there's a reason that people shoot film, and that's because of the mechanics, the nostalgia, and because of just the whole overall experience of shooting it.
The shooting experience, there you go. It's not because of the look. I mean, of course I like a good, we said it, Portia 400 look and the tones and the skin tones and just the grain also is something that's it's hard to replicate. To go back to the answer, I love it on the video side because I think it's the closest thing to shooting film in video, like the good old Kodak film that they had back then. But I will admit that on the Lightroom side, there are other options, and I am actually using another option that emulates Kodak or Fuji film, and it's pretty darn good. And it's pretty darn good on those DNG file that I tend to shoot lately. So I will send you the link to those. They're a bit expensive, but again, nothing is free in this world. And these guys who are developing these plugins and programs spend a lot of time, effort, and R&D doing so. But it's the best of both worlds. But it's nothing like the shooting experience of the full blown shooting film. And that's something that people should understand. It's if you want your photo to look exactly like Portia 400, buy a film camera and a Portia 400 roll. You know.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, but it is interesting to see how what it's doing. And it's funny that you have a reservation with the photo part, but not the video part, because it would be so much more expensive to shoot a video on one of these film stocks than it would be to shoot a roll of it. Although it's still expensive either way you do it. I like your take on that. It's very interesting.
Well, I'm going to test it before making a full-blown opinion and release it on YouTube. So who will release it first? Is it? Well, you're way more advanced than me. You're testing it right now, right?
Yeah, I'm just in the Lightroom. But the thing is, I'm working with my friend who works at Indie Film Labs, and I want him to give me his honest opinion about it because he knows everything. Yeah. And I think I've sent him a few images and he's been pretty harsh about a few of the film stocks. So I'm really excited to see his personal opinion.
He's like, dude, no, it can't be exactly like film. Yeah. And he's probably right. But
there's some of them he said he'd be fooled by. So that's, I think I'm going to have a list of the ones that are like the ones that look the most like, and then the ones that are just not there yet.
That's great, and we're looking forward for that video. Speaking of YouTube, what did YouTube bring you over the past? How long have you been on YouTube?
Oh man, way too long to have the amount of subscribers I did. I just was so inconsistent that I said that this is my inconsistent YouTube channel, and that was the way I started my videos off for the longest time. And finally, I've kind of gotten some kind of consistency, so I had to take that out.
Yeah.
And I never really took it seriously until like the last year and a half, or I would say probably a year, really. I just kind of did it whenever I had my free time. But what it brings to me is a community of people that actually want to talk about what you have to offer. And to me, that's very important. I think that the community thing is not there on Instagram. It's more like, hey, great photo, thanks, you know, whatever. And in YouTube, you really kind of get down and talk about very, very detailed subjects very quickly, because there's so many people out there that want to learn. And I think that's just the best tool for people to learn. And I want to help people learn. I love to talk about all this stuff. That's not just my job, my hobby, like my life. I love it. So that's, it just brings me even more joy than just photography in general, because I can talk to people about it.
Yeah. I think you and I are have so much in common, because same for me. I mean, I've been on YouTube, man, there's a video that dates back to 2011 where I unboxed the X100, believe it or not. If you can find that video, I'll send you a free download, a free percentage off of my new zine. It's just like you. I mean, I was going there just because, probably because I had more questions than answers. I wanted to ask questions, and it was a nice, you know, video format with the comments below and so on. And ended up finding, like you, a community of passionate, you know, like-minded people that want to, for the most part, you know, be helpful and help each other and so on. So I prefer, and I don't know if I can say that on this podcast, but I prefer the community on YouTube than on any other platform, whether it's Instagram or even Vero for that matter. A lot of hype around that platform too, but because I think it's more, to your point, in depth, it's also people can see your face, so they can see who you are and not just a photo that you scroll, you know, half of a second on a certain algorithm driven platform or ad based algorithm driven platform.
Yeah.
So I like YouTube, and I like your YouTube channel for that reason too, because I think there's a place, and I wish you to have a million subscribers, but I think there is a place for a smaller creator like you and I, where we're not just paid by big brands to, you know, vehiculate a message or a new camera that's came out. Like we said earlier, we use what we use and we share what we know, and we don't have all the answers, but we might have, you know, a little bit less biased opinion on, you know, plugins, cameras, and so on and so forth. So I don't know if you feel the same, but that's how I feel being on YouTube.
I think I've never thought about being a big YouTuber. Like, I celebrated 4,000 subscribers the other day, and I was like, yeah, that took me, you know, 10 years to do or whatever. But not that I cared until like the last year. And I'm not trying to be like a big YouTuber. I just want to talk to more people, and that's really it. Like, I think 10,000 eventually would be awesome, and that would be fine with me. And I think you're right about the small YouTubes, because once you get to the bigger people, they don't talk back to you, because there's so many comments. And I'm like, well, that just seems exhausting. And it seems like I would hate to be put in a position where I couldn't answer every question. And right now I'm at a point where it's easy, and I enjoy that about my channel. So I'm okay with where I'm at, and I wouldn't mind just getting a little bit higher, and then that would be good for me.
Well, I will definitely put the links down below, and please do me a favor and go subscribe to Hunter's channel. It's one of the good ones out there. I feel that, you know, you, me, Lucas, that we just talked about.
Lucas is great.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Bunch of you guys.
We should be
really good YouTube videos.
Should maybe maybe do a collab or something at some point.
We could.
We're all in different parts of the world, but
I do a video challenge. It's called a distant challenge, and it didn't really get a ton of views or anything.
Okay.
But it would be me and another photographer using the same camera, and like one of them was like an F8 challenge, so everything had to be shot at F8. Only portraits though. And that was it. So we had to do portraiture with F8. You had to be very creative, because otherwise most people use like, you know, 1.2 or 1.4 shooting portraits, going to blow the background out. Yeah. So having nice compositions in that. So we could do like some kind of challenge in a way that would be interesting. I wouldn't mind doing that. So.
I'm in. And we'll tell Lucas to, and I'm sure there's other people who might be interested. So let's do it, man.
Yeah. Cool, man.
So please follow our channels if you want to stay up to date with that. Hunter, we're approaching the end of that podcast, but what's next for you? What are the projects that get you excited, and how can people find more about them?
Right now I'm just working. I'm just pushing forward. I've been working on a project. It's called Artist 23, and it's supposed to be 23 artists that I photograph, and I haven't released anything about it yet because I haven't got to 23 people yet. So I have to have 23 people in the year 2023. It started in 2022, didn't finish it, so now it's 23.
That's
I'm just going to have to add numbers to it. But and I will be going to Italy next week for a week, so that'll be fun to kind of do. That's the first time I've ever been, so that'll be the first time I've ever been. So I don't really have anything other than that, just kind of doing things that I always do. portraits and documentary work.
Well,
Instagram is the best way to see what I'm doing, honestly, because it's so easy just to throw something up. So
absolutely.
Hunter Hart Photo.
And yep. You are, yeah, Hunter Hart Photo, the Nashville photographer on Instagram.
Yeah.
And also that's you've me. Got your website at thehunterhart.com.
Yeah, it sounds kind of arrogant, but Hunter Hart was taken, so.
Oh, there you go. And of course, on YouTube, you are Hunter Hart. So thank you. Thank you so much, Hunter. It's been a real pleasure to connect with you, to get to know the guy behind the camera, behind the great photos that we're seeing on all those platforms. So I want to thank you for sharing all of this great stuff with us today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Have a good one. Oh!